Indie Media is DIY news. It is about people reporting their own news directly without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media.
There are 100 Indie Media or IMC websites worldwide providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns and protests.
There are so many people here who are saying no to the government today, and this is democracy in action.
Everybody's here. Everybody in the country seems to be here. They're just coming from all over the place. The banners are showing all the tiny, tiny little pockets of the country. Everybody has come down here.
The project started 3 years ago covering the massive Seattle protests which shut down the World Trade Organization's summit.
Uncensored and unsponsored, IMC sites can be updated anywhere, anytime, by anyone.
The open to all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news. What you are about to hear are some highlights from these global websites and from our very own UK IMC Wire. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
The world is waking outside my window. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Drags my senses into the sunlight, for there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now, I have to leave you. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. With my friends now, up to the city. We're gonna shake the gates of hell, and I will tell them, we will tell them.
Hello, coming up on the show today, we have all the usual stories from the Indie Media news wires, and we have interviews with Grattan, who represents the Roma Federation of Great Britain, because there's been moves on the Roma population since we've had advances for the British National Party. But now, first of all, an art show.
After 6 months of preparation, London Rising Tide climate change activists have occupied 50 Chalk Farm Road, transforming it into the central London locations for the exhibition of resistance to big oil and the corporate hijacking of the arts. London Rising Tide says, "This artwork accurately paints a true portrait of an oil company. It is powerful, contemporary and disturbing." The artwork exhibition can be viewed from today and the 21st of June. There will also be workshops and events during the week, including speakers from West Papa and Columbia, a jam night, film night and lots of other stuff, such as painting, subvertising, guerrilla cinema, radio, food and discussion. Later today, they will also hold a Greenwasher Rust street party with live performances, an open mic and performances from the singer David Rovix. They plan to start from 4 p.m. at BP headquarters, St. James's Square, before moving to the BP-sponsored National Portrait Awards private view at the National Portrait Gallery on St. Martin's Lane, followed by the opening of the art exhibition at 50 Chalk Farm Road.
Hooray!
Martin Doyle, a participating artist, stated, "As an artist, I'm appalled by BP's sponsorship of the arts, which gives the impression that the art world condones the company's activities around the world." A London Rising Tide activist pointed out that in previous years, the National Portrait Awards were sponsored by John Player, a tobacco company, and it appears oil companies have followed suit. Sarah Newby said, "It's time to meet the increased corporate hijacks of the arts with defiant creativity. Time to kick the corporates out of our galleries, museums and theatres." For more information and background, see www.londonrisingtide.org.uk.
Following months of speculation over the location of the 2005 G8 summit in the UK and reports that all police leave in Edinburgh and Scotland will be cancelled next summer, oh dear, the Gleneagles Hotel in Perthshire, Scotland was finally confirmed as the venue last week as the 2004 G8 meeting in Sea Island, America drew to a close. The Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi beat Mr. Blair to the Gleneagles announcement by informing the Italian press that the leaders had all been invited to Scotland. Mr. Berlusconi said Mr. Blair had told them, "You will all have to wear kilts." Nothing wrong with that. Later, when Blair was asked by the press if he wanted to apologise to the people of the Glen Eagles area for the mayhem that would come with the G8 summit, Mr Blair said simply something like, "Yes, I suppose I should. Yes, is probably the answer." Blair also said, "Hopefully then we will have a series of actions," but that's shamefully quoted out of context. The G8 will be held on the 6th and the 8th of July 2005. Policing and security costs are expected to hit at least £150 million, with at least 10,000 police being deployed to seal off the area around Glen Eagles. Police have already vowed that anyone planning to cause disruption or in or around the Glen Eagles area will be dealt with using the full force of the law. The last time the G8 met in the UK was in Birmingham in May 1998. Then up to 70,000 people encircled the centre of Birmingham, forming a human chain and demanding an end to third world debt. On the same day, up to 7,000 people took control of the centre of Birmingham for the second global Reclaim the Streets party, with actions and protests happening against the G8 in around 40 cities across the world, with over 400 social movements taking coordinated action under the banner of People's Global Action, PGA. 6 years and many mobilisations later, people in the UK have been organising around the G8 for several months. A growing new network of local groups has been created called the Dissent Network, with nodes across the country. Dissent is planning a series of awareness-raising events through the year and has been calling for both local and international participation. Many people and groups are now focusing on planning protests and direct action campaigns against the G8. Recently, many NGO organisations are also coordinating on a level unseen since the Jubilee 2000 Drop the Debt campaigns and are set to try and take advantage of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's aim to pitch the UK presidency of the G8 as a positive step towards reducing third world debt and around issues of development and trade. 2005 is also the 20th anniversary of the Live Aid concert. Several groups are expected to use the European Social Forum in London in October later this year as a platform from which to launch campaigns. Recently, several trade union leaders, politicians and globalised resistance have also issued their first call for protests. For more information, check out indymedia.org.uk.
Saturday 26th of June will see the beginning of the preliminary hearings for the 29 Italian policemen and officers who faced charges related to the brutal nighttime raid on the Diaz School in Genoa, Italy, during the anti-G8 demonstrations there in 2001, where scores of people were beaten, many left unconscious and hospitalised, before later being tortured in a detention centre. For more details on that, see Indie Media Italy at italy.indymedia.org. At the same time in Switzerland, the court case against four people from the Abion Bridge action at the 2003 G8 summit in Evian will begin. UK climber and activist Martin Shaw was cut from a climbing rope he was dangling from by police, falling over 20 metres onto a riverbed and sustaining very serious injuries. While the policeman who cut the ropes remains on duty, ironically, the four protesters, including Martin and the other climber, have all been charged with blocking the traffic and endangering human life. Alongside, a European anti-repression meeting will take place on the 26th and 27th of June to promote wider awareness of the many different cases of repression that have happened recently and to discuss proposals and strategies for creating a stronger and more effective anti-repression network in Europe. For more details, see Indie Media Switzerland at www.indiemedia.ch.
Check.
Last week, on June the 10th, 2004, Irish activist Caoimhe Butterley began 14-day hunger strike in appeal for the cessation of Israeli companies and complicity in human violations. Irish activist Caoimhe Butterley began the first day of a two-week hunger strike on June the 10th. It was a water-only hunger strike outside Cement Roadstone Holdy Fitzwilliam Square in Ireland. The hunger strike has been initiated in an attempt to focus on direct Irish complicity in the construction of Israel's apartheid wall, which violates international law and contributes to grave violations of the Palestinian people. Cement Roadstone Holdy owns a 25% share of Nesha Cement, the sole provider for cement in Israel. Amnesty International recently stated that through subsidiaries Masha and Nesha, it's likely to be providing material for the wall and contravenes the responsibilities of the transnational corporations and other enterprises with regards to human rights. The apartheid wall, which is 8 metres high in some places, is responsible for the de facto annexation of over 50% of Palestinian agriculture, although Irish authorities attempt to sanitise this by referring to it as a security or a defensive measure. It repeatedly condemned internationally as a land grab and further solidification of a system of apartheid. Close to 90% of the wall is being built on Palestinian land inside the West Bank and cuts off families and communities from each other, separating from their land. The wall poses unprecedented restrictions on Palestinians within occupied Palestine. Palestinian activists and farmers have been killed or wounded while demonstrating against its construction. Caoimhe Butterley states, "It is shameful that an Irish company profits from anything that is immoral, unjust and destructive. The construction of this wall is all of those things. This fast is being initiated to pressure the cement company to divest from these companies and its options. At a time when the Israeli occupation forces act with increasing impunity in their violent humiliation and brutalisation of the Palestinians, Irish civil society must take a stand." So, we'll finish there. Caoimhe is on a hunger strike. Gerry Adams and lots of people have gone along to offer Caoimhe support. And we wish her luck with that and all power to her.
spotlighting the World Bank
and International Monetary Fund on their 60th anniversary, a London Indie Media Cinema screening at The Other Cinema in Soho, with filmmakers Q&A and a speaker from the Bretton Woods Project. First up is Suits and Savages, Why the World Bank Won't Save the World. The Global Environment Facility, GEF, looks promising on paper. Billions of dollars of official aid for global conservation. But does this new multilateral financial institution live up to its own rhetoric? Suits and Savages examines a GEF World Bank eco-development project from the ground up, from one remote tribe in southern India to another far more powerful in Washington, D.C. That's preceded by Crowd Bites Wolf, The Czech Connection by Gorilla Vision, the world's biggest poverty peddlers, the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, scuttle off to Prague in September 2000, but an international army of insurrection is waiting. Caught in the middle of the black bloc, the pink and silver bloc, and the revolutionary fever, feather dusters and firebombs, one man finds his anticipated fortnight on the piss shelved by a chance encounter, from the makers of Rattle in Seattle. And Two Trevors Go to Washington, an international and humorous account of IMF and World Bank meetings and protests as seen through the eyes of two South Africans. Finance Mr. Trevor Manuel calls for internal reform while on the streets. Former ANC councillor Trevor Ngwane joins protesters calling for immediate debt cancellation and an end to devastating policies promoting by the IMF and World Bank. The tale of globalisation is told through contrasting perspectives and the intertwining adventures of the two Trevors. Through their often humorous adventures, we get the unique inside pictures of the commanding heights of the world economy and of the protest movement that has emerged to challenge them. That's Thursday, 24th of June from 9 p.m. at The Other Cinema, 11 Rupert Street, Soho. Nearest tubes are Piccadilly Circus or Leicester Square.
Okay, a dirty tricks campaign ended this week as the Crown withdrew four stone-throwing allegations against an activist from the Blackwood anti-roads protests. The under-sheriff and two policemen had previously all stated these false allegations in their statements, effectively conspiring to pervert the course of justice. At his third court appearance, the activist known as Boris confessed to throwing two eggs at the under-sheriff of Blackwood during the evictions of the tree camps earlier this year and was sentenced to a 12-month conditional discharge. Boris, who has now vowed to end his egg-throwing career in favour of non-violent vegan actions, was also fined £43 costs. In the late afternoon, Hayes, a witness, reported seeing a person who looked remarkably like Boris happily removing exactly £43 worth of Costain's road marker posts beneath the shadows of what's left of St David's Woods. Now we're going to a Heaven Over track. Hello. Posted to The Wire yesterday and today was some news about evictions of travellers from Epping Forest. And we have here with us Grattan from the Roma Federation of Great Britain. And I just wanted to have a chat with you, Grattan, about what exactly is going on in Epping at the moment.
Okay, well, what's happening there is that the Epping Council have for some time been trying to get travellers from a piece of land at Payne's Lane Caravan Park, and it's at Lower Nasing. And there's a man there, Harry Smith, and his wife Linda, and some other families, the Delaneys, who some of them have been living there for 14 years, but about over the past year there have been various enforcement notice and refusal of planning, and now it's come to a crunch this morning. In fact, I see it's now just 1:30, and if the Delaneys are not leaving that piece of land now at this 1:30, they can be taken off and put in prison for 9 months. So 9 months in prison for leaving your own land, which pretty well puts in a nutshell the problems of travellers today.
So do they own the land?
Own the land, yes. They've owned the land, and they've been putting in for planning permission. They've made various appeals. The local council, many people are not aware of this, but a local council can just tolerate the presence of travellers, as they've been asked to do by the government. So the local council could say, well, look, we're not going to require you to need that planning permission. We're just going to let you carry on there, and if everything's okay, let it go ahead.
So,
but in this case, they've taken a very hard line. And what worries us is that the BNP has just won 3 seats to Epping Forest District Council, and we feel this is their pledge to move. They said in their manifesto that they would immediately move travellers on, and here we're seeing this happening this morning.
So it's scapegoating, basically.
That's what we feel, yes. I mean, I've been looking at this for a long time. I've been involved for 40 years, and back in the 1960s, travellers could find places to pull in. You could pull in on a roadside. You could find common land. But now that's impossible, especially since the Criminal Justice Act of 1994. You simply cannot get a place to stop without being harassed by police, by the local authority, and so on.
So they own the land, and
yeah,
it's basically racism, really, which means that they're not getting planning permission because they just want to put their caravans on this land and have a place to just hole up and live their lives.
Well, anybody you talked on the council, of course, they'll deny it's racism, but we feel it is a form of ethnic cleansing which is hiding itself behind planning regulations, and that really it's motivated by ignorance about travellers and at one extreme hatred of travellers, because we've had people being attacked. The Delaney's own relation, young Johnny Delaney, 15-year-old boy, was murdered by a group of racist youths who set upon him on some common land and beat him to death in a public park, that was, rather.
When
so
was
it's
this?
A very sad situation, and there's very little tolerance to go around.
Were the people who attacked Johnny Delaney, were they apprehended? Have they been charged?
Yes, they were charged. Yes, they were. They've been charged. They've got 4 years in prison, which Johnny Delaney's parents think is a very light sentence. But yes, they were apprehended, and they were taken to prison. And there's been another case which, you know, we could say, well, this is a small victory for travellers. Two men who abused travellers racially have been fined £1,000 each for racial abuse against travellers, which I think is another landmark case.
This seems really ironic to me. Somebody only gets 4 years, or a group of people only get 4 years for murdering a boy, yet the Delaney family can get 9 months for refusing to leave land which they actually own for the kind of heinous crime of putting some caravans on a land without permission.
That's right. The most extreme instance we've seen recently is the destruction of the Meadowlands Caravan Park at Chelmsford, where a group of 12 families got together. They purchased a field for £90,000, put in for planning, and in the meanwhile, they had nowhere else to go. They moved in and they created a very decent caravan park, but it didn't get planning permission, and eventually, 18 months further on, the council decided to use direct action, and bulldozers were brought there, riot police, 100 riot police, and during that eviction, several caravans were burnt. The mobile home of a young mother called Kath, Kathleen Buckland, was burnt to ashes, and she's now trying to mount a human rights case to get justice that way, but it's going to take a long time, and meanwhile, she and others have nowhere to go.
Well, where are they at the moment?
Well, like the Delaneys, they've had to move, they've had to go to another unauthorised place, which I wouldn't like to mention where it is, because it simply brings attention to them, and they're going to be pressured to move on from there, but they've had to go on to another place in Essex, an unauthorised caravan park, and hang on. And what is trying our patience so hard is the government appears unwilling to get around to taking a grip on this problem and saying, look, it'll have to be a duty reimposed on local councils to provide caravan parks, to provide the villages that are needed so that travellers can have a secure home and can send their children to school without the fear that when they come out of school their homes are being moved on. We hope that'll happen, but there's very, very little sign of it. In fact, it's the other way, because we're seeing the rise of a very hard attitude. There's five people in the BNP, perhaps they're only a small party, but we fear that that kind of pressure is being brought to bear on local councils to take a hard line and make life practically impossible for travellers.
If people want to help or offer any support to these campaigns and the families that are being affected and treated so badly, who should they contact?
Well, the best people at the moment to contact are the Gypsy Council, and they can certainly call me on 01206 523 528, and I'm very glad to be able to tell people, you know, individually and, you know, with some discretion about what the latest action that's needed. We're hoping, for instance, that people will join us on going back to the Meadowlands Caravan Park. It's a beautiful piece of land, and we could have a summer camp there and perhaps draw attention to the problem that way.
That sounds really good. Hopefully people will join. I'm going to say that number one more time. This is Grattan's number for anyone out there that would like to offer support to the families, to the Delaneys. Their telephone number is... Grattan's telephone number is 01206 523 528. So, is there anything else? You were telling me earlier about other families in Essex that are also facing eviction in Basildon?
Well, that's right. There's a very large community of travellers at Dale Farm near Basildon. Of course, that's Basildon Newtown. And Basildon is about to build another 8,000 houses, but apparently they will not tolerate this community, which has really sprung up and become a virtual village of its own at Craze Hill. The families there are just putting together money now to build their own community centre, and they've got their children going to school, but they're under a very serious threat of having the whole of Dale Farm razed to the ground after the 13th of May next year. They've been given some leeway. They've been given a few more months. That's through to May next year, but after that, the crunch will come, and there's quite a strong opposition to them being allowed to remain there. Again, it's their own land, and but they face eviction with nowhere to go. And what kind of highlights this, you know, talking about this whole problem here today, is that it's the fifth anniversary of the Kosovo ethnic cleansing, when gypsies, about 120,000 gypsies, Roma, were ethnically cleansed from Kosovo on this day 5 years ago, and here we are with very little attention being given to it. And of course the problems in the UK are not on the scale that they are in Kosovo, but nevertheless on a smaller scale we are suffering from a policy of ethnic cleansing and a lack of tolerance and a rising racism, and it's pretty awful.
Sounds really frightening. Is there any other organisation that people could get involved with to offer assistance?
As I say, I myself linked with the Roma Federation, and we linked together the Roma travellers, and well, get in touch with me, and I'll be very glad to talk to anybody who's got some thoughts of supporting us.
Thanks very much for talking to us, and good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Backs against the wall. Dear brother, backs against the wall. Backs against the wall. No Babylon city I go fall. Hey, what you do when the Babylon gate
black. The poor thing to have a roadblock. The city you've been caught in a dead trap. The mother we style and I was a comeback. What the thing when the mark at the beast traps. Say the one where they are back to mark of day attack. Got the money in your pocket, it's no water jack. Say you better get ready for the hotter claps.
Listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Your radical radio.
US President Bush is expected in Ireland on the 25th, 26th of June for an EU-US summit which takes place in County Clare. With less than 2 weeks to go, Anti-War Ireland and other campaign groups have been calling on opponents of war to get ready to give Bush the, quote, unwelcome he deserves, and to once again impress upon the government that refuelling of US military warplanes at Shannon Airport is illegal, immoral and unacceptable. Anti-War Ireland, a broad-based alliance of independent anti-war groups, has called a demonstration at Shannon for Friday the 25th of June. The demonstration is intended as an entirely peaceful and mass mobilisation in opposition to the visit of George W. Bush to Ireland, against the occupation of Iraq, against the militarisation of Shannon Airport, and against Irish government complicity in what they describe as criminal adventures of Bush and his cohorts. The protest is also in support of activist Mary Kelly and the Pit Stop Ploughshares defendants who face charges for criminal damage after many acts of property destruction against military airplanes. There are also several other demonstrations and actions planned during the visit. For more details, see Indie Media Ireland at www.indiemedia.ie.
Coming to Ireland for 2 days only, the EU-US summit. A sordid tale of corruption, greed, war and lies, starring George W. Bush as the evil emperor. Co-starring Tony Blair as his faithful sidekick. Berlusconi plays himself as the Italian dictator, and bit part Bertie's first and final role. Come join an all-star cast in what is promised to be the performance of a decade. A futuristic plotline that sees all crazy Texan half-wit bring the world to the brink of all-out war and environmental disaster. Only you, the Rebel Alliance, can save the show.
And that's about it from our show this week. So please check out the Indie Media Wire for more news from the streets. Hopefully you can get along to the BP oil exhibition tonight. That looks like it's going to be really good fun. So goodbye from us here in the studio at Resonance FM 104.4. We're going to go out with a long kind of outro, which is a medley of usual activist madness. Bye-bye.
In Nova Scotia earlier today, the ocean rose by 25 feet, which, incredible as it sounds, looks more and more like a tropical hurricane. If this system moves south, we could see a wind-driven storm surge that could threaten the entire eastern seaboard.
The popularity of the new film The Day After Tomorrow has put the issue of global climate change at the forefront of American consciousness. While most moviegoers dismiss the film's doomsday predictions as sci-fi fantasy, some climatologists and concerned citizens are seizing on the opportunity to talk about the realities of global warming. The Day After Tomorrow opens with a team of scientists surveying the North Pole. In an instant, a crack splits the ice shelf, nearly killing the researchers. The filmmakers would have us believe that this event leads to a sudden, catastrophic rise in sea levels, resulting in extreme weather patterns all over the planet. Within days, the effects are felt as a snowstorm falls in New Delhi, India, grapefruit-sized hail rains down on Tokyo, Japan, tornadoes destroy the City of Angels, a tidal wave floods New York, and a new ice age engulfs the Northern Hemisphere.
I think the beginning part of it does depart from science, and from then on it's an action Hollywood film.
Max Boykoff, a graduate student in the Environmental Studies program at UC Santa Cruz, saw The Day After Tomorrow and feels it could have been made to be more realistic. Ultimately, though, Boykoff says the Hollywood blockbuster will force its viewers to address their own role in changing the Earth's climate.
I mean, if people start talking about it, if they think about what could happen, I consider that a good thing. You know, while the science kind of presents more of a doomsday scenario than is probable at this point, those things are still possible.
4 years ago, researchers learned that a mile-wide patch of the North Pole had completely melted into the ocean. Over the last half century, the Arctic ice cap has thinned by over 40%.
You know, the globe has been warming, the climate has been changing at an alarming rate, and we're at a time when greenhouse gas emissions are unprecedented. Carbon dioxide emissions are higher than they've been before.
To dramatize the situation, Boykoff donned a Santa Claus suit and walked along the Santa Cruz Beach Street promenade on a recent Saturday, holding a handmade sign which read, "Save Santa's Workshop, Stop Global Warming." He engaged some in conversation and passed out flyers, urging people to take a number of simple steps to reduce their own ecological footprint. Similar actions took place in Florida, Washington, D.C., and Portland, Oregon.
We all know that there are natural variations that occur on the Earth over periods of time. However, the human contribution is the important component, and that is where we are meddling in the climate system.
While some in the scientific community have scoffed at the idea, they represent a small minority, according to Boykoff.
I'd like to point out that there's a UN-sponsored, United Nations-sponsored intergovernmental panel on climate change, where 2,500 of the top climate scientists from around the world have come together and have reached consensus that humans have a discernible influence on the climate.
Most of the skeptics even would go along with that.
Kevin Trenberth agrees. Trenberth is head of the climate analysis section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and was a lead author of the 2001 climate change report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Each year is one of the top, in the top 10 of the warmest years on record, year after year. And that's been true ever since this became a high-profile issue.
According to figures obtained from the Union of Concerned Scientists, 7 of the 10 warmest years in the 20th century occurred in the 1990s. Again, Kevin Trember.
We have very good evidence that the composition of the atmosphere is changing. Carbon dioxide levels are 31% above what they were in pre-industrial levels, and half of that increase has occurred since 1965. We know it's caused by humans, mainly burning of fossil fuels. And to the extent that these are greenhouse gases and they produce a heating of the climate system, then global warming is definitely happening.
So what impact does global warming have on the planet? Tremberth says scientists are studying the potential for long-term shifts in rain patterns and widespread droughts in many parts of the U.S. But much research already done on the subject concludes that
Sea level has gone up an inch and a quarter in the last 10 years. We've got very good measurements from space. And so this increases coastal erosion and has impacts around coasts, and that's only going to get worse. There is melting of glaciers, very prominent in Glacier National Park up in Alaska and in Europe nowadays. There's been chunks of what is called the Laffan B ice shelf off of Antarctica that have broken off. The ocean temperatures are rising. The ocean is expanding. Sea level is going up because of the ocean expansion and also because of the increased melting of glaciers, which means there's more water in the ocean. And so these kinds of things are happening and are going to continue.
And what can be done to reverse these trends?
Cutting back on the burning of fossil fuels is a key thing in order to slow down the rates of climate change being produced by this.
Hands down, the United States is the world's biggest polluter, responsible for more than 25% of the planet's greenhouse gas emissions. Despite this fact, U.S. leaders for years have balked at signing on to the Kyoto Protocol, an agreement between nations to implement policies reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Without the U.S. on board, the Kyoto Protocol would be an ineffective means to slow down the global warming trend. Meanwhile, a bill introduced by Senators John McCain and Joseph Lieberman called the Climate Stewardship Act would require polluting industries to make modest cuts in carbon dioxide emissions. Boykoff supports the bill, but cautions that it's only a start.
If you're looking to impact most, so to speak, you would like the United States federally behind the Bush administration to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. However, this is a good first step to get the U.S. moving in that direction domestically. The bottom line is that we need to be aware that this is happening. And a lot of times through the mainstream media, there are different veils that get put over this issue that skew and distort what is really going on here. There's consensus that global warming is happening now and that we need to do something about it.
This is the B-Man reporting for Freak Radio in Santa Cruz, California.
May 28th through the 21st was D.C. Black Pride. It started as a continuation of the Children's Hour Party held annually since 1975 on Memorial Day weekend. The annual event became a magnet for black LGBT people around the country and now draws thousands a year.
My name is Earl Folks, and D.C. Black Pride has been around since 1991. This is our 14th year. There are 32 black prides around the country, and I guess one in South Africa and Toronto.
Earl Folks helped to organize this year's D.C. Black Pride.
Theodore Kirkland and Wilmore Cook, who's deceased, and Ernest Hopkins are the three co-founders. And what they did was they decided they wanted to raise money and awareness for some of the struggling AIDS organizations that serve the African-American community. So they had a little picnic, and they had about 900 people. The first year, which shocked them, they weren't expecting about 300, and the weather was bad. And from that, we've grown from being on Banneker Field over the last 14 years to being in the convention center, in essence being the largest gathering of African-American, black, LGBT in the country under one roof. As long as we continue to be conscious of the needs of our community and the diversity within our community, we're not monolithic, and try to plan things that span generations and span gender and truly be LGBT, and we work really hard and struggle with that diversity issue. Our board reflects men, women, transgender, bisexual, and when struggle with that and plan programs like that, we're going to be relevant, and people are going to see that and they're going to respond in a positive way.
Bridges tells of one of the many issues facing GLBT couples. Currently, laws in many countries discriminate against people who maintain non-traditional family units, making it hard for them or impossible to seek protection for their families under the law.
My partner and I, we've recently had a commitment ceremony. Living in Virginia, we don't have laws for adoption, and if I did get pregnant by some other means and we decided to have a child, it's kind of hard for us to have my partner as the legal guardian because they just won't allow it. And so in the event that something happens to me, you know, I'm kind of leery about having a child because I don't want something to happen to me and then my partner doesn't have custody of the child. So that's the major issue for me.
She said it all.
Let them whisper, for they know not what's between.
That voice that makes Giuliani so scared, he hires two butch black bodyguards. I want to write the poem that the New York Times will not print because it might start some kind of black or lesbian or even white revolution. I want to go to secret meetings and under the guise of female friendship, I want to bed the women of those young and eager revolutionaries with too much zeal for their cause and too little passion for the women who follow them from city to city. All the while waiting in separate rooms, I want to be 40 years old and weigh 300 pounds and ride a motorcycle in the wintertime. Four hell-raising children and a 110-pound female lover who writes poetry about my life and my children, and loves me like no one has ever loved me before. I want to be the girl your parents will use as a bad example of a lady. I want to be the politician who never lies. I'd like to be that girl who never, ever cries. I want to go down in history in a chapter marked miscellaneous because the writers could find no other way to categorize me. In this world where classification is key, I want to erase the straight lines so I can be me.
One of the struggles that LGBT people of color continue to face is the issue of visibility.
I know it was Gil Scott-Heron who said the revolution will not be televised, so my membership in the revolution will not be based on how slanted are my eyes on the prize, fight with all my might, girl, watch my finger unfurl. You picked the wrong Asian woman to mess with, because my tongue is split, it is forked and steel-tipped, and it will puncture and bleed you, and if you don't know...
Washington, D.C. has one of the largest Asian populations in the country.
Now you know!
Listen, don't ask me what I'm saying in my native tongue. You want to know so badly, go learn it yourself.
Despite the number of Asian, Asian American, and Pacific Islander people that call D.C. their home, community organizers say that there is a lack of services across the board for these communities.
20 years it took me to perfect the language my mother's and her mother spoke. 20 seconds it took you the nerve to ask what my sister and I spoke about.
Chani Min, the director of LGBT affairs at the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, organizes around raising awareness about social and political issues that affect the queer APA community, like immigration or language accessibility to health care.
If I said I wasn't talking to you, why don't you stop bothering me all up in my business? How dare you step to me, invade my privacy, waste my time to ask if I'm able to relay you the content in my conversation? What nonsense is this? Do I look like your private translator? Or you probably thought dialogue centered around you and you just wanted to make sure. Is that because you're paranoid and insecure or just jealous because my tongue's got more skills than yours?
For LGBT Asian Pacific American folks, APA, the lack of visibility is compounded by how society treats their sexual identity.
I'm a woman, not a flavor.
I'm a woman, not a flavor.
I'm a woman, not a flavor, not the flavor of a woman.
Ask me why I'm so defensive. I find your incentives so insensitive. Help make sense of this. You've concealed your culture confiscation with racial toleration, claiming that you're embracing and any interest taken is a form of learning and acceptance. So you want to learn how to say I love you and hello. Why you need to know? You think of me as some Asian hoe, ready to turn around at your cause of,
hey baby, on your Annyeonghaseyo,
or
Ni hao ma, I love you, China doll.
Please, your shit doesn't impress me at all, because my words were meant to be mentioned in a meticulous and mellifluous manner, yet you're mispronouncing manhandling mouth. My meaning's misused for miscommunication, misconstrued to a misinterpreted, misspoken. It makes me mad, so you better have listened, asshole, and listen well. Don't talk to me anymore, because I'm done talking to you!
Take the toys from the boys.
Make the bomb out of cotton.
Take the hands off the guns.
Make the bomb out of coffee.
Take the fingers off the trigger. The toys from the boys.
We gotta make a living.
Take the hands off the guns.
We gotta make a killing.
Get the fingers off the button.
We gotta get the
toys from the boys. Take the toys from the boys.
Made a bullet out of rubber.
Take their eyes off the dials.
Made a cannon out of water.
Get their minds off the money.